Well, that's a young man by the name of Freddie Hubbard, relatively new to the jazz scene on trumpet back in 1959, when this tune, I Heard That, was recorded on the album Go, featuring the Paul Chambers Quintet. Paul, of course, the legendary bassist. Cannonball Adderley was on alto sax, Wynton Kelly on piano, and Jimmy Cobb on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Friday, June the 12th, and we're picking up from where we left off with this week-long series encouraging a re-examination, or for some, an examination of what it means to initiate reforms that speak to the unique interests of people who consider themselves oppressed. And I say it that way because, you know, many people who are oppressed really don't consider themselves oppressed at all. But, of course, they are oppressed. So it's about attempting to address this question of what do we consider our reality to be in the United States? How much longer do we continue in this vein that we are fine? We are one of the best well-organized societies on the planet. Democracy and freedom and all these high-minded ideals prevail. Yes, it's not perfect, but it is pretty close. And certainly far better than anything else on the planet that we have right now. These things are necessary, as I described, as part of the creation myth, the creation story. Like any other dogma, you reinforce the power equation, you reinforce this conditioning through creation myths and creation stories. So we're going to be talking today about what kinds of self-created social, political, and economic systems can we implement immediately, begin the process of implementing them immediately, having immediate effect. If we agree, or if we believe, that the system is organized is not operating in the best interest of huge numbers of people, then what is the alternative? We don't hear about the alternative because, of course, we're not supposed to hear about the alternative. The whole idea is that there should be no alternative. The system as designed should be the thing that we know and adhere to and go with. We're not supposed to think about alternatives because that in itself is a kind of an act of revolution. And systems don't tolerate revolutions too well. Not even here in the great, the seat of democracy. Not a good appetite for constructing alternative systems. A story appeared today that kind of illustrates the points I've been making all week. And you would say, I don't see it, but give me a little room and I'll explain. The Progressive Baptist, the Progressive National Baptist Convention will be exhorting Washington on the 25th of June, through a kind of conference and rally. You know, they're very, very good at conferences and rallies. To do what? The goal is to restore the Voting Rights Act. And there's a great hue and cry about the Voting Rights Act and the need to restore the Voting Rights Act of 1964, passed under the administration of Lyndon Baines Johnson, and it became effective if you recall, in 1965, considered a landmark piece of legislation, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the movement sparked by King, and not at all by King, but we had the more militant wings of the movement, SNCC, you had the Panthers, you had a wide range of people who were operating outside of the status quo, organizing because this was seen as a very, very important pillar for freedom in that time. This is 1964. And it was part of the general foment about this demonstration forcing the system to concede that it had an obligation to protect under the law the rights of all citizens and to grant under the law the rights of all citizens. Okay, great point. But the Progressive National Baptist Convention, this is a group of black churches. It's a very impressive group, said to be a very powerful group, and mostly of black churches in this country. They're going to go to Washington on Thursday, June the 25th, to bring home the point that the voting rights, protections of voting rights, must be upheld. All right, sounds good. Well, here's a little thing. Remember, I'm talking in historical context, and I'm talking about systems and how systems work, and I thought this was a really nice example. Now, why would there be a need at all if there were truth to this idea that the system, the overarching system under which we all live, is genuinely interested in democracy? Why would there be a need for this discussion at all? Why would it not be natural, almost automatic, that any impediment to what could be seen as the democratic and constitutional rights of vast numbers, millions of its citizens, why would it become a fight at all? Why would there be a resistance to it? Well, going back to the point that I had made, a system is designed, it's scientifically designed to maintain certain groups in power or to retain power in the hands of the power elite and to deny others their rightful powers and privileges. So this is the tug of war. And I talked about the fact that systems are scientifically designed. They don't leave anything to chance. And they use the very laws that are supposed to be agencies of liberation to do the exact opposite, to oppress. In this case, the fight actually began way, way before 1964. Because this issue of voting rights was tied to the question of citizenship. Who are Americans? Who are the real Americans? Who ought to enjoy the rights and privileges of American citizenship? And, of course, you know, very early on and from the very beginning, a certain group of people, people of African descent, you do not at all deserve to be citizens of this country. You are not citizens of this country. You were not meant to be citizens of this country. Therefore, you should not enjoy any privileges of citizenship. This goes back a long way. And we have so many cases attached to this question of who gets to be a citizen? Who is an American? The same people who came here and slaughtered generations of the undesirable element who were here long before they were, who came here with genocidal intent and with the intent also to control forever a landmass and everything on it, in it, over it, under it, and around it, to keep that power in perpetuity. These are the same people, having taken that power by force, by war, by all kinds of underhanded means, slaughter, genocide, oppression, are now in a position of deciding, well, do we admit this group to the club, or do we exclude that group from the club? You see? And the discussions that we have been having as a nation, which are largely theoretical, because they don't nearly come close to the reality that we really ought to be discussing, takes the form of these esoteric questions, takes the form of hypotheticals. And so we see U.S. Supreme Court cases arguing the technicality of Dred Scott, the technicality of all of these cases of housing discrimination, the technicality of, police intent, when it basically amounts to the same, it brings us back to the same argument. Do African Americans in this country enjoy the rights and privileges and protections of the law? The law is now used openly and blatantly against them. And this has been going on for a long time. The 15th Amendment, passed in 1870, presumably granted the rights of citizens. This is what it says. I'm reading here. The 15th Amendment granted African American men, because at that time, voting was a right exercised by men. So we had that division already taken care of, and by white men, being absolute about who is to have power in this country. Declaring that the right, this is the quote, the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Now, that was ratified on February the 3rd, 1870, but for more than a century, it didn't take. For more than a century, that just did not apply. Now, you see the contradictions, which is what I say about the idea that the system is riddled with psychosis. People doing very odd things. They ratify something to give constitutional protection to a group they never intended to give constitutional protections to. And it would take another century and more. Now, this is ratified in 1870, but it is not until 1964 that we have this discussion about the Voting Rights Act. You see what I mean? The system refuses and is designed with all manners of ways to frustrate the humanity that it says it actually imbues and it manifests. Now, the question here, coming to the kernel of our discussions, what if what would have happened had, let's say, the Progressive National Baptist Convention, instead of going to Washington to beg again, please, could you do the right thing? What if this group decided, you know what, we are going to announce a whole new system. We are, in fact, a powerful group. We have influence. What if we, instead of going to Washington, D.C. on the 25th of June to beg and plead again about the system doing the right thing around this business of voting, what if we were to declare a bill of no confidence? What if we were to vote and openly declare we have no confidence in the system? And I think from 1870 to 2015, remember I was telling you, you have at some point to make a decision based on evidence whether a thing is factual or not. Now, we are not counting. I'm only counting from 1870. I'm not counting from 1619. Okay, when the first Africans were brought here in chains. I'm going really liberal on this one, saying we will count from 1870. By the way, I just want to remind you, the nation became a nation in 1776. And look how long for them to even deal with the issue, 1870. And from 1870, nothing happened until 1964. And from 1964 to 2015, we are still fighting about the same thing. So is it unreasonable to conclude that this system has made it abundantly clear that African Americans, specifically, because this is all about African Americans here, are to be denied their rights, that they therefore are not citizens of this country, that it is reasonable for any African American to conclude this system has targeted me to deny me my allegedly constitutionally protected rights. I think it is reasonable for anybody to conclude that. Now, what if this group of leaders, this august body of people who stand tall in their respective communities all across the nation, command the attention every single Sunday of millions of blacks, bringing their souls to the church for salvation, looking to them for leadership? What if this body were to do something pretty radical, well within the body of evidence that they speak for these oppressed groups, but not with this idea that they're penitent and begging still and pleading in 2015, could you please find it in your heart to do the right thing? We're still talking this nonsense in 2015. Could you please, please, please be fair? Could you observe the law? Could you do the right thing? And instead say, you know what? From 1870, with the passage of the 15th Amendment, to 2015, we are convinced that this system does not intend to extend, let alone protect, the constitutional rights of African Americans. And therefore, we openly condemn it, And therefore, we hereby openly declare we vote no confidence in the system, nor the Supreme Court, nor the presidency, nor any other authority, if it cannot guarantee this basic right. We openly declare that we are moving out of it. We are suggesting that people do not vote. Don't vote. Because again, here's the psychotic behavior. They don't want to protect the right to vote by law, and yet they insist that you vote. The president, the African-American president, runs around telling people how important it is to vote. He is at the top of the chain. He is the man. And he's sitting at the helm of a system that governs even him, that allows him to do what they want him to do, and that gives him hell if he doesn't do what they want him to do. And here's this is just an example. It's a very poignant example. But this is the psychotic nature of the existence that we have. But instead, would these leaders do that? No. No. Because as I discussed, this is a perfect story to illustrate all these points we've been talking about all week. I discussed that part of the science of racial oppression in this country is that it creates a psychosis even within the groups that are oppressed. They refuse to see to their interests. They buy into the system. The same leaders of the National Baptist Convention, and they call themselves what? Progressive. We're not just regular Baptists. We are progressive, and we're national. The Progressive National Baptist Convention doesn't have any guts to say, we're standing up. We're standing up, and we're confronting the system. Know why? Because when you look at it, what did we see in Ferguson? What did we see in New York? Where all these, in Cleveland, in Baltimore, in all of these places where we recently saw this conflagration, this historic conflagration erupting once again, we saw this group playing their predictable role as the people who keep the lid on righteous revolution. Their job is to go to bat. Al Sharpton, great example. Jesse Jackson before him, running as an insurgent, and next thing you know, he's put every person back on the auction block in service of the Democratic Party, in service of white supremacy, in service of the system. Now, that's what we have to deal with in modern times, and Dr. Amos Wilson helped explain this whole thing about the history is about progression and regression. We are in massive regression right now, massive regression. And this series is about trying to encourage progression. Progression. But we are in massive regression. Everything tells us that. These leaders, come June the 25th, it would be more important to them to have media coverage than to actually achieve liberation. It would be more important to them how many cameras are in the room that they hold these news conferences and inform people. It is more important to them. That is more important to them, the warm glow of the television cameras, than actual liberation. Now, let us go back to 1964 for a moment, because an important point needs to be made here. And that is, what was Martin Luther King in 1964? Well, certainly, we are told he was a dreamer. This guy was just harmless. They've seen to it to make him innocuous, non-threatening. But in fact, he was quite threatening to the system. The system understood that. But what happened? What was it that brought Martin Luther King in 1964 to that point of openly confronting the system? Martin Luther King had made a very significant transition, and this is the transition we too must make. He went from mobilizing to organizing. Mobilizing is good. It helps to encourage a political consciousness. It's a very important tool to get people hip, as they say, to what is happening. And it begins the process of galvanizing people in a common cause that they can see is to their collective benefit. But it is when you start organizing, that is when you become a power entity. And if we understand how this goes, we see every time in our leadership that a person arrives or a movement arrives at a point of critical mass. Something dramatic happens to quash it. And in our history here, we have seen time and again the state directing unspeakable violence, assassinations and jails, illegal jail time and all this kind of stuff, simply to break the back and bring that movement to a screeching halt. In other words, every time you push forward, there will be a force to push you back. Now, that should not in any way scare us. The Progressive National Baptist Convention, I will contend, I'll get some letters after I say this. But compare the political mindset and even the spiritual commitment of the Progressive National Baptist Convention to the likes of preachers who put themselves on the line to fight slavery, to fight the race oppression in America. And there are many of them. Many, many of them. Many black churches were actually born in the crucible of resistance and battle against injustice. The leaders we have today are accommodationists. Same industry, if you will. But one group in the worst of times, nonetheless spoke up, nonetheless did the work, nonetheless built churches that were systems, not only of resistance, but systems of survival. with that kind of spiritual guidance, people learned the fine art of pooling their resources, of taking care of each other, of buying land and working the land and feeding yourself, of building schools. Morehouse was born in a basement, and the money initially came from people, including former slaves. You understand? So this is what happens when people are conscious and they understand that their role is to be part of the continuum of struggle in behalf of others, not for yourself, not so that you can get a nice embossed invitation to the White House to have salmon on the glass or in aspic. And here, presented to me today, almost by fate, this story came to me, and I said, perfect example of what it is we've been talking about. When people were committed to progress, this is now in the preacher world, all right, in the church world, the black church world. When they were committed, they built their own institutions. And those institutions stood firm. When everything else in the neighborhood was crumbling, they stood firm. And when I say institutions, I don't mean big, glorious cathedrals, as in the today's world where we have people basically raising or wanting to raise, like Creflo Dollar, $65 million for a personal jet. This is the kind of obscenity we have by people who are delusional and people who have lost their minds, which, of course, is part of the byproduct of an oppressive system. It causes you have to, a requirement is, you must lose your mind. You are required to be insane within your own body. You're required to lose all reference to logic and history. And that's what we have. So, going back to my earliest premise this week, when you take stock of the statistics and the history and the facts, you can therefore determine the reality of your existence. And it is valid. It is valid. I'll take this break, and when I come back, I'll talk about ways in which we have to start thinking about organizing different kinds of systems that suit our needs.
You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Yatrice Lead, and of course, we're continuing our discussion. Now, what can you do? What can you do? It's so daunting, and I mean, I'm not trying to suggest that this, what we're talking about, is an easy thing at all. I'm just trying to ignite the idea in our heads that we, at some point, have to stop deluding ourselves about the reality that we're living in. And once we get that done, we can then begin the process of figuring out what's a good alternative, what's a workable alternative. Well, the first thing is, I think, to deal with the situation as it is. Not with any malice, not with any, just clinically deal with the situation. What is the reality here? Are you an oppressed person? Do you consider yourself oppressed? Do you consider yourself, and when I say oppressed, I don't have the right word for it. And I don't mean to use the word oppressed as a way of indicating that you have no alternative, or that it is a psychological condition that you can't basically get out of. Not at all. I'm saying that you have to recognize the limitations within which you are operating and be real about those conditions. What is it that is running your life? And to what degree do you have control over your life? And beyond that, do you see yourself as part of a community of people who are similarly situated? That, in effect, is what a class action is all about. A particular case is brought in behalf of numbers of people similarly situated. We are encouraged, part of our reality is we are encouraged not to think that way. We are encouraged to think about what's happening to me. And if it is happening to me, therefore it's a universal concept. No. We can see the link with all of these police killings that we've been talking about. If people don't understand that that is a class of people who are targeted, again, don't waste time arguing. Just understand that these are people who desire to be intentionally ignorant, and you just move on. You don't have time to, you know, get into these esoteric discussions. Encourage them to read, encourage them to educate themselves, but absolutely move on. I think you have to work on yourself first with that reality and fix yourself first. I mean, you could get help, and you will, of course, bond with other people on the same journey with you, but you have to do this work yourself. This is work you have to do yourself. You can't assign this to anybody. Because if you're going to be part of the whole, you don't want to be a person infecting or reinfecting the whole. You want to be in reasonably decent shape psychologically, politically, to participate and to move forward. You want to be a good soldier. So you have to educate yourself. I think you need in small ways, and small is a very deceptive word, because a small thing achieved is a huge deal. It may be, for example, quote, small as looking at where you're banking, choosing a different way of banking, choosing to eat differently. It may be a small thing as deciding that you're not going to spend money needlessly, that you're going to save. A small thing like directing some extra dollars to causes that you desire to help succeed. That's a small thing. It may be $10. It may be $5. But it is the discipline of doing it and the consciousness of doing it that makes it a huge victory, personal victory. You have moved out of your proscribed environment, psychologically, economically, politically. A small thing may be to see to it that the block that you live on looks clean. It may be a small thing, but once done, and done consistently, it is a huge victory. So, when I say start small, I mean chip off a piece that you could handle from beginning to end with predictable success. Because these things are within your control and you can get them done. A small thing may just be making sure that you have dinner with your family every night, that you talk, that you visit with friends or maintain contact regularly, or that you read. You get good books that get you educated. It's a small thing, you may say. But if you do it and you accomplish it and you do that regularly, it's a huge victory. It's progress. And you should celebrate these things. A small thing would be deciding who should be in your circle and what circles you should be in. Are you going to be hanging around with people who are negative? Are you going to be hanging around with people who bring nothing to you and your life? Or are you going to move away from that and create an environment for yourself far more conducive to your progress and your future? Small thing, but hugely important. Are you going to continue to sail through your life without understanding where you came from, who your people are, what the struggles have been, what the milestones have been, an appreciation of your culture, which is a life-sustaining force in itself? Very important. So start there. We'll get into the big things later on, but I'm talking about starting where you can. Start where you are. And change some of the things that you absolutely can change. You may think that you are alone, okay? So then you create a family. You create your family. You're perfectly capable of doing that. And you create communities. It may be only about five or six people, but if you have five or six incredible people in your life, well, you have achieved a huge thing. Five or six real good people in your life, well, you're off to a great start. You don't have to get all big and, you know, this is not monumental stuff. I'm talking about you start small. Those things that you can do and work at achieving that lift you up, that get you ready for the big break away from a system. But you have to condition yourself, like any athlete. You know, Usain Bolt didn't just come out of his mother's womb with wings on his feet. It's practice,
practice, you do the thing over and over, you condition yourself, you get to learn about the task ahead and how to prepare yourself for it. And no matter where we are in the scheme of life, I talked yesterday about the horizontal plane of history and we chugging along with the rest of society on that level, but we also have that vertical plane where we are strictly concerned with whether we are ascending or descending in terms of where it is we see ourselves, where we want to go. And a large part of our lives will be determined within these two axes. How society is going, whether we chug along with it, and how we are going, whether we are growing or we're not, stagnated or we're just descending. We got to get ready. If you believe, as I do, that we are in a state of, we're beyond crisis, really, let's face it. We are beyond crisis in so many ways, on so many levels. We are in meltdown. In some communities, the word crisis is an understatement. They're in meltdown, designed meltdown. This is what a system does. And in all these different ways, we are basically rushing to put out fires all over the place, which suggests we don't have systems of our own. We have to create them. They are very, very important. They are key to our continued survival. And more so, they are absolutely necessary for those coming behind. What is it that we can do now to kind of attenuate the impact that we know will come if we do nothing, or if we do something stupid like go along with the system? And this applies across the board. This is the question, these are the questions that we need to ask each other as well. What are you doing? What are you up to? How do we work together? We don't have to be, you know, married to each other. But if we find, once we work on ourselves and we have our system, coalition is yet another system. You see? If you understand this whole thing as a series of systems that you can design and use strategically to your advantage when you need to do it, and to the broader good when that needs to happen, you need to design these systems. Now, I'm sure people are saying, well, geez, why are you talking so much about oppressed people? Well, because one, it's real. I consider myself an oppressed person. I don't want to be oppressed. But a system has been designed long before I was even born, that determined long before I got here on this planet what my fate would be. And what my fate should be, how far I could go in life, what kinds of things I can achieve and attain, what wealth and prosperity I ought to enjoy. They made these decisions. So I'm under no illusions about my individual power and authority to basically dictate the rest of my life. Many, many things have been impediments in my life. I didn't want them there. I didn't ask for them to be there. But they're there, and they have been there. So early on,
the message I got, and which I basically see as the message people like me have been getting all our lives, is one of containment. But you have to battle against it, because the psychosis belongs not to you. The craziness, the inhumanity, the denial of your rights, the intent to grind you into dust, this didn't come from you. And so you have to be smart to organize against it. It happens in this country because we are a race-based, a racist, apartheid society. It happens that for most people who are oppressed, the number one common denominator is the color of their skin. It's bizarre. It is a sick kind of way to think. It is downright, it's so abominable, it defies description that people could operate this way. But it is nonetheless the reality. And so we have to bear that in mind as we construct systems, effective systems against it. Or else we just have no choice but to just allow ourselves to be doomed. I'm not of that mentality. I think we ought to plan something against it. We ought to gird ourselves. We ought to know what is happening. We ought to be conscious of it. We should not be ducking and, you know, ducking the issue. We ought to come at it. And it's okay. People don't want to engage in the conversation. Good for them. That's okay. But you still, it does not change the reality with which we have to live. I'm not waiting for people to engage in the discussion. I'm sparking it. Hopefully, it will continue beyond this week. And that is my sincere desire, my sincere hope, that we get this business of constructing alternative systems that speak to our unique needs. Stay tuned. Coming up next is the Lifeboat Hour with Carol Baker. And certainly you can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. I love hearing from you. I'm really working hard to catch up on my mail. I think I've done a good job so far. I have a little bit more to go, but really I thank you so much for your good thoughts and prayers and your good wishes that I improve. I feel good. And in any event, I'm going to go ahead with my business. This is what I love to do. This is what I desire to do. This is what I'm going to do. So I'm doing my job. And I want us all, in whatever way we can, to just do that. Do your job. And do it with a special kind of purpose, a special consciousness, because that is the service that we can render to the larger society. So thank you so much for being with me today. As you know, we're working to get the phone lines tested again and retested as PRN has moved into its very nice studios. I hope to see them soon. And so we will be able to interact with each other as we customarily do here on PRN. That should be next week. Fingers crossed, I'm hoping for that to happen. Thank you so much. Thank you so very much for the pleasure and privilege of your company. Please treat yourself nicely. This is the weekend. Connect with people who are meaningful in your life in a meaningful way and move forward. It's so much harder to hit a moving target. I'll see you on Monday. Bye-bye.